Today's guest is Richard Sutton, and if you've ever wondered how some people manage to walk through absolute chaos and come out sharper, calmer, and somehow stronger on the other side, you're about to find out why. Richard isn't just an author. His books Thrive, Stress Proof, and The Stress Code have become playbooks for high performers and everyday people who want to turn stress into fuel. He's worked with athletes, executives, and global change makers, distilling cutting-edge behavioral science into tools that actually work in the real world. We're going to talk about the mechanics of resilience, why your brain reacts the way it does under pressure, and how to re-engineer your responses so you can perform not just when life is easy, but when it's messy, unpredictable, and high stakes. Rich, before we get into your books and your work with high performers, if you woke up tomorrow in a completely different life, a different career, different skills, no one knew your name, but you still had the mindset you've developed over the years, what would you do first?
And while you were saying that, talking about the question, I was thinking, like, what would it be? And I really love what I do. It's like, it would be torture. It would be torture. I feel like this role in this world, in this universe that I live in is the mission. It's the purpose. It's the North Star. And it's very difficult to consider something else.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Yeah. So you've worked with everyone from Olympic athletes to top execs. What first drew you into the world of performance and coaching and stress science?
What drew me there was one of these moments in one's own life, and just seeing the value of physical well-being, physical health, physical fitness, and its relationship to mental and emotional well-being. And just to take you back to that time, I grew up in a tough home, but a lot of people grew up in a tough home, and it was difficult. Because by the time I'd finished high school, I exited that environment feeling very defeated, very, very compromised. Kind of life wasn't about opportunity. It's whatever would kind of fall in your lap, or whatever would come your way. And there weren't big ambitions. There weren't big goals. And I grew up in a time where we still had national service and we're going through a major recalibration in South African society. And I was very resistant, and I protested, tried to get out of national service. I couldn't. And I was drafted to the Navy, and I arrived in that environment, arrived there very unfit and very emotionally fragile, and mentally just didn't have that extra gear. And the environment was very tough. It was brutally
yeah.
tough. And the first couple of weeks, I was the guy at the back, and it's not good to be the guy at the back in that environment, so I can assure you.
Yeah.
And it was you kind of getting isolated and you exposed. Week three passes, and the narrative that's playing in my mind is, I can't do this. This is hard. This is impossible. This is hard. This is impossible. And week four passes, and it becomes all consuming, overwhelming. And there's no way to get out of it. As a national serviceman, there is no way to get out of it.
Yeah.
This is the path. You're going down this road, whether you like it or not. And I started feeling very low, very, very compromised on an emotional level, very compromised on a physical level as well. I just wasn't cutting it. And got to about the sixth, seventh week. And in that period of time, there was this shift. There was this kind of change in how I was feeling physically. From the back, I started moving to the middle. And we had one of these opportunities. It was a Saturday afternoon, and within the national service, like, basic training model, you don't ever walk. It's you run everywhere you go. Your whole environment is very active. But there was an exception, because on this Saturday, there was a rugby match. The Springboks were playing someone, and the base went silent, and I had this opportunity to just walk around. And I was based in Saldanha, beautiful environment. But I never saw the reality, because I was so consumed by how hard the reality was and how vigorous and how demanding the experience was. And I go for a walk, and it's the first time I've actually walked, and I look at the ocean, I look at the setting, I look at the sand dunes, and I kind of reflect on where I'm at and the whole situation, the whole reality of the situation. And I begin this dialogue in my own head.
Yeah.
And up until that point, when I say up until that point, my entire life up until that point, as 18 years old, was you can't. It's impossible. It's too hard. You need to be saved. There's no ownership. You're an object. You're being battered around, being thrown around by situations and environments that are greater than you, and you have no voice and you have no say. That was my internal narrative. And there was this moment where I realized that nothing is going to change. I'm there for the long haul. Either I make the most of it, either I embrace the situation, or I'm going to be some sort of statistic somewhere along the line. And it was this turning point where I shifted from I can't, and it's impossible, and it's all too demanding, to I can and I will. Literally, I can and I will. And I took that with me. It was a simple mantra. I took that with me into the next day, and there was this shift, the shift in terms of it's going to be hard, but I'm going to get through it. And what I noticed was this parallel is that it seemed to align with improved physical fitness, and the two started feeding on each other, the mental and emotional well-being and strength and the physical fitness, to the extent where a few weeks later I was in the front of any of the exercises, any of the drills, and it was a very empowering feeling to go. I think it's the distance traveled more than anything. It wasn't about being in the front or being at the back. It was where you came from and what you were able to achieve. And I saw the power of our dialogue, our internal narrative, but it was facilitated and augmented by this physical piece. And I saw this relationship and how what you thought you could achieve for life and what you really can achieve for life are two different things.
I love that. That is so powerful because nothing on your in your environment had changed at all. It is just you had changed your mind in that moment, which changed everything. And that is the most powerful thing you can do.
And to that point, it was the state, the physical state, your neurochemistry, your biology was starting to shift through these positive health behaviors. I was in nature all the time. I was outdoors all the time. I was with a group of people that were going through the same thing. So I had a supportive infrastructure, which I never had before. I was physically active all the time. I wasn't overeating. It was like the whole environment started creating this metabolic and biological shift. And that in turn started creating the opportunity to change behavior, to change perception, to change ultimately my reality.
What was it about you that enabled this reframe to take place? Because it sounds like you were just feeling helpless and hopeless initially, but something in you decided it's time for a reframe, and that's a big thing.
It's a strange thing because at that point I felt empowered enough physically to make one statement to myself, and that statement was enough. It's enough.
I love that. I love that. I think we've all got to have that conversation with ourselves several times in our lives. And it's the only thing that works. So, outside of your professional work, what habits and passions and drives keep you grounded and energized and striving towards that mindset?
So I think, the passion piece, I think, is the energy, it's the fuel. And if you find your passion, I think everything else will organically flow. And we all have different passions. Some of our passions are self-growth, where if I'm improving today versus where I am tomorrow, that's the thing. Or where I was yesterday, the only person you're really comparing yourself to who you were yesterday. If I'm building relationships with others, that might be the passion piece. Or it might be if I'm representing excellence, might be the passion piece. Or if I'm making a difference to other people, might be the passion piece. Or if I'm changing society, might be the passion piece. So I think it's really identifying those elements.
I think that's quite tricky because, I mean, you and I both work in industries that we're passionate about. We love what we do. We're excited to do the next thing. We're excited to write the next book and speak to people because that's what gives us fire. But when you work with, and I know you work with corporates, when you're working in a room of corporates and these are people saying call centers, man, I can think of nothing I want to do less with my life. Or people in banks or people in any industry. And they have, it seems like they're just grinding through the day. How do you help people like that start finding where their passion lies?
So it's passion's a funny thing because it comes and it goes. We assume that just because today we found our passion, it's sustained. It's not always. So where do you start in this continuum? I think you talk about a call center, and here you've got this work that is repetitive. This You've got confrontation, you've got hostility on the other end. It's not extremely high paid. I mean, it's very difficult to find your compass in that environment, but one has to ask the question, why am I doing this in the first place? And it could be family members you're supporting. It could be a life you're trying to create. So I think that in those situations, sometimes you have to lock into why and what is the bigger picture? And where do I go from here? So I think that piece on the why, and it's a deep reflection. Some people don't have a why at this point in time. But the one thing that I've learned is that when it comes to infusing energy into any given situation, any transformation or recalibration in life, it's very difficult to re-infuse or create change when it's purely for yourself. So if I'm trying to, I say, oh, I've got to eat a little bit better because of X, Y, and Z for myself. No, it's for a week, maybe. If I say that I'm 53 and I've got a 3-year-old and I want to be around a long time, I've got to eat a lot better. Easy. Easy. It's for someone else. It's not for me. So I think it's locking into the why, and it's locking into your contribution to those that are important to you. And that creates the driving force sometimes.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about resilience. Now, this is a phrase that's been thrown around the self-help circles for a long time. And the question that came up for me when I was doing a bit of background research is, do you think resilience is nature or nurture or both?
It's a combination of both. So like there's four elements that one has to consider with resilience. A very, very good question this, because on the one hand, there's a genetic component. There's a very, very strong genetic component. There's 13 genes that have been researched that have a direct bearing on your capacity to handle change and uncertainty and complexity and demand.
Interesting.
So 13 genes, but those genes represent seven molecular system. So one could be the stress axis, the other could be dopamine, serotonin, neurochemicals that influence motivation and mood and behavior and cognition and so on. So there's a big genetic component, but the genetic component's sitting at around 30 to 40%. But even if you don't have the right genes to be resilient, and I mean, there's no bad gene, one can alter one's experience. One can alter experience by the choices we make, because as I mentioned earlier, there's at the end of the day, no good or bad gene. There's vulnerability genes, which if you are, like myself, I've got many genes that are technically vulnerable to difficult situations or hostile environments, and I just have to create the right choice of the right behaviors, the right controls. And by doing so, I mitigate the risk completely. So it's again, it's choices and a behavior, but you need to be informed, and the genetics it plays a role. The second pillar is there's a lifestyle piece. When I say a lifestyle piece, a childhood piece, where what we experienced in a time where we were fragile, experienced in a time where we're vulnerable, influences our realities and behaviors as an adult. So, so often we assume that, we had trauma, we've got to get over it, we've got to bounce back. But the reality of traumas is they have very distinct and very specific footprints on our reality. So if we experience uncertainty as a child, or financial uncertainty or parental divorce, and we felt very unsafe, it makes us very reactive to stress, very reactive to difficult situations, very reactive to uncertainty. We're kind of very jumpy. I think that's the best way to describe it. Conversely, if we had tremendous like physical trauma or sexual trauma, our stress axis is very negatively calibrated, to the extent that it's magnified. Any additional stress as an adult, no matter what it is amplified like hundreds of percent. So we have these disproportional responses to events that happen to us. So it does carry through. Lastly, if we experience neglect or psychological abuse, it has its own footprint and its own signature. And that signature is we can't shut down, we can't regulate. So when we do get stressed, we ruminate a lot more, and it's much more sustained. It's not calibrated. So it does carry through. And our past, unfortunately or fortunately, does reflect our future. And sometimes to become more resilient, we have to go back. And whether it's healing those wounds or reconciling or becoming a stress master, whatever it is, we have to consider that. So those are two components. But then our personalities is a reflection of the environment we grew up, our genetics, and the behaviors we take on, our personality. If we're optimistic, we're a little bit more resilient. If we're extroverted, we're more resilient. If we're pessimistic and neurotic, we're less resilient. So there's five or six characteristics that determine our resiliency just based on personalities. And the final piece is skills. So we can learn these skills by emulating others. We can actively and consciously develop these skills. But it's certain behaviors that can make us, we can determine our resilience by these behaviors. And those four parts really, it's the interplay, it's the dance between those four parts that ultimately culminates in our ability to be prepared for the future or feel quite exposed by the challenges that lie ahead.
Yeah, I think a lot of people walk around with blinkers on. There's people all over the place that we come in contact with, whether it be at work, whether it be at seminars, and they're just going through life. And I think there's a lot of these people who would love to know their stress personality, why they react the way they do. And I think it's one thing being curious and seeking answers, but is there a way of really understanding yourself that, yeah, I suppose you could go for therapy. I suppose you can go and see a coach. But what do you think is the most effective way? Buy one of your books, for example, to really understand your your stress personality and how you can turn stress into a performance enhancer rather than something that takes you out.
So I think it really boils down to simplicity. Simplicity is you had a difficult past, you're going to struggle with stress, period. It's like that's the reality. And as a consequence, I think you have to become more invested in managing your stress. And stress to manage is not difficult. It's actually really not. I wouldn't even use the word management in stress because you can master it. Stress is like a huge opportunity. I feel if you're in a stressful job or stressful family environment or stressful environment, well, all of us are, to be quite honest. You have to become a stress master. It's a formula, it's a framework. I don't think there's any situation really in this life that we live where we don't have to be mindful and we don't have to be deliberate about managing our stress. But I think the most important thing to consider is that we're in control. We choose our path, we choose our destination. And all we need to do is upskill in terms of understanding the stress piece and upskill in terms of what it takes to be resilient in an environment that is so unpredictable, is so uncertain.
So many high-performing athletes, executives struggle with burnout. And burnout is, again, it's another thing that is thrown around. People don't really understand what burnout is. They also don't know how to deal with it. And in your third book, Thrive, you outline strategies to prevent burnout. Which do you think most people underestimate? And how do you recognize the signs before it even becomes a major issue? Because it can really take you out.
So, burnout's a funny thing because there's environmental factors and there's personal factors. So, environmental factors, those things around us that are sometimes beyond our control, things like injustice, feeling like an environment's not fair, deadlines are a big trigger, long working hours are a big trigger, lack of support's a big trigger. There's many contributing factors that are outside of ourselves, but ultimately, the biggest driver of burnout lies within. And I would say that if you distill it and you say, like, what is it? Ultimately, it's the need to prove oneself. Now, you could need to prove yourself because of you just ambition. You're so ambitious and you want to represent excellence and you want to do striving. You're just constantly striving. That might be a positive. Sometimes there's no fallback. You have to prove yourself. There's no option. You have to make this work. And sometimes it could be you need validation. So you're pushing yourself and you want to be accepted, you want to be liked, you want to be loved, you want to be recognized. But it's not to say that this ambition piece is a negative piece. It's a very positive piece. It's when ambition meets neglecting own personal needs. So when we neglect our own personal needs and we're ambitious,
Yes.
that's the formula.
Yes. No.
And all of a sudden there's no time. There's no time to look after yourself. There's no time for non work-related activities that becomes destructive. And then you start denying it and say, oh, no, it's not really that bad. And we start finding ourselves in this kind of second stage as we're not flexible. We're not flexible emotionally, mentally, on any level.
Yeah.
And then burnout starts progressing. These are stages of
Yeah.
burnout. and then I'm just withdrawn a little bit. I'm not there.
Mm.
And start using direction. Where am I actually going? Who am I? And then everything's cynical, no matter who's doing what and why and how well they're doing, it's just everything's bad. And then me kind of following that series of kind of these three stages of no time for anything, reduced flexibility, like I'm withdrawing from the world. Only then do we start noticing the behavioral changes, just becoming emotional, like I'm not myself, I'm reactive. And then you disassociate. Sometimes I can be talking to you and I'm disassociated. I almost don't feel like I'm there. I feel so empty and I become obsessive and then I become anxious and then I become depressed and then there's the physical. So this burnout, it's a very complex set, many, many different parts, but we always assume that it's physical, it's depletion, it's exhaustion. No, it starts mental, emotional, behavioral, and it begins ultimately with neglect of self.
And I can completely relate to that. So, I'm wondering, just listening to you, where this originates. Does it start? Where in life does it start that we neglect self? Is it performance at school? Is it something that somebody else said? Is it a perception of not being good enough, lack of self-esteem? And I always ask myself when I have got to a point where I know I'm heading down the burnout route and I'm talking myself through it, is I ask myself, whose voice is that? Because it's not my voice. My voice is not the one saying illness is a weakness, or you've got to just push through, or you can only rest when. That's not my voice. For me, that's my dad's voice, because that's who he was. And that is the person in my life that I can't say I aspired to be him, but he was an influence in my life. And for many people, I think it could be a teacher, it could be a coach, it could be definitely a family member. What are your thoughts about the early influences in our life that lead us to a point where we start neglecting self?
So it almost seems like a situation where it's binary, where ambition is a negative, but it doesn't have to be that way. And I think that it doesn't have to be at ambition to the expense of self. And I think it's somewhere in the early narrative is when you're in pursuit of excellence, and excellence is very difficult, different to perfection. Perfection is I'm not allowed to make mistakes. I'm not allowed to look vulnerable. I'm not allowed to look weak. I'm not allowed to underproduce. That's perfection. It's
It's
not
not real.
real. Excellence is an achievement that this is the direction I want to go. I want to do extraordinary things in life, and I'm going to make lots of mistakes, and I'm going to fail. I'm going to be embarrassed, and it's okay, because every time that there is a setback or there is a failure, I'm going to grow. I'm going to learn. I'm going to evolve, and that's my journey. But in pursuit of X, if that's a life that I choose, if that's a life that I want, it's not a bad thing. It's not good or bad to be ambitious or to seek excellence because it come at a cost. It's not good or bad. I have to acknowledge that with this increased effort and increased commitment to this path and this journey, I have to also acknowledge that I'm human. There's this factor, this output is not something that's limitless. So if I'm pursuing excellence, I've got to balance and match output with restoration. And somewhere in the early narratives, this restoration piece got lost. So we look at sportsmen and we say, oh, amazing, look what they've been able to achieve. They've been able to do things that we couldn't even imagine were possible. But we fail to look at their routine. The vast majority of the day is regenerative. So yes, there's maximum output for hours on end, 4 or 6 hours of training and inputs, but there's also 3, 4, 5 hours of therapies and regeneration and targeted nutrition to balance the system. So I think it's more a social and societal thing where the expectation is don't sleep, keep going, keep going, keep going. It's volume-based, not qualitative.
What I wanted to say was, let's just step back a couple of years, and I'm curious, what drove you to go into performance coaching? I mean, you've coached athletes, you coach execs. What was the thing that happened in your life that drove you to that place?
Truthfully, I grew up in a home that was very hostile, and it was relentless. It's to the point where I worked at night to get out of the house. I went to school in the day, so I spent as little time. But the one time there was peace, is when there was sports on.
Ah.
And it was just this place that I always felt anything is possible in those moments where nothing was possible. And kind of bringing that mentality that came many, many years later in doing national service, the mission was, I want to be supporting athletes. I want to be supporting high performers, be their best. I want to facilitate their lives. And that's the world that I want to be associated with. I want to live in that world because that world is a world where anything is possible, no matter how hard it gets. I didn't know how to do it. I honestly did not know how I was going to do it. I didn't know. I knew I wanted to go. I didn't know what the steps were, where it was going to take me. But the North Star, the mission was set. And
Yes.
to be at the top of that world means to be with a winning Olympic team. That is the top of that world. And until that was achieved, I was the prime candidate for burnout, but I always looked after myself. There was this balance between the two.
That's incredible because I firmly believe that once you've found your passion and you have seen the North Star, there's nothing that will stop you getting there. It's just a case of putting one foot in front of the other because then the path reveals itself. You've just got to know what path you're on.
I think, and what you define now is clarity. I think when we have clarity, everything, as you said, everything falls into place. But so few of us have that clarity. There's so much happening around. There's so much information. There's so many conversations. There's so many expectations that we sometimes fail to go in and find what do we want? Who do we want to be? It's more important to identify identity than desire. Because the identity will ultimately culminate in the desire.
So, I mean, you started off in sports performance and excellence coaching. How did you evolve that into, I don't want to use it, it sounds like a cliche, but it really isn't, the corporate athlete type of training, where you take those principles of, I always talk to my corporates when I'm teaching nutrition, with the same principles that I teach an athlete, that an athlete recovers more than they train. They eat more than they train. That you've got to recover. You've got to honor the body. How did you take the principles of coaching athletes through to other disciplines?
It was to go back to that North Star is once you've achieved that North Star, you've got to recalibrate your life. And it's a very hard point in life. Because if this is the thing that's been driving you, it's your fuel. I want to be in a senior role with a winning Olympic team. And 2008, you achieve that. Now what? What do you do? It's the mission's done. And I'm starting to look around. I'm nearing 40 years old. And I have to make a decision. Am I going to live this life where you essentially alone, you don't have a family, you don't have, or am I going to recalibrate and look at things through a different lens? And I took a very bold decision. I wanted kids, I wanted a family, I wanted a stable life, and I didn't know how, again, that's what I wanted. I didn't know how I was going to get it. And so I took a decision to start reducing my role in sports, and it took many years. It wasn't overnight. And I moved back to South Africa, and literally, kind of, I can't work in that world in this environment. It's a different world. I've got a different skill set, and it's just not equitable. And I'm kind of thinking like, what am I going to do next? And these principles are powerful because. Over the period of 20, 25 years that I worked in professional sports, I came to realize that the X factor is psychological. I started that journey on, I believe the X factor was physical superiority, technical prowess. I exited that world knowing that it's a series of skills, the skills that make us better under pressure. If you can handle the pressure, you'll be extraordinary. That bottom line. So armed with that knowledge and those insights, I arrived back in South Africa and a few of my friends have done very well in business and kind of connect with them, and they're struggling with different issues. And I start having chats with them. And they say, could we do this a little bit more formally? So the chat kind of grows. They said, would you be able to do this with my team? They're struggling with this particular scenario, or the change, or the restructuring, or the growth. And one team grew, can you do it with our entire organization? And that expanded, and then they're doing it. So maybe another organization will start, and it kind of organically grew. But it's very much the same world. It's not, there's no different. You know, so often you believe that an athlete is a very different engine to a CEO. There's no, I haven't seen a difference. They're the same person. One using their mind to advance their professional career. The other's using their physicality, but the physicality without the mind doesn't advance the career. And the mind without health and well-being and vitality doesn't advance your agenda either. So the two are just slight nuances. And it became very easy fit. I was basically doing my old job in an environment that is much more challenging. Business is more challenging than sport. Sport is predictable. You plan on Saturday. Business, it could happen any day. There's so many X factors, external factors, geopolitical, socioeconomic, environmental. So it's crazy. So it became a very, very stimulant, very exciting. I love that space. Absolutely love this paper. So much complex, so many layers to it.
Absolutely. And athletes listen to exactly what you say and they just go off and do it where everyone else has got their own agenda, so it is far more challenging.
True story.
So I'm interested in your book writing journey. When did that all start? Because you've written three books with a fourth one on the way, which we'll dig into now. But how did that all begin for you? Because it's a life of its own. And every author has a story about their story. So how did it begin for you?
So it began by the kind of really understanding that the defining element in athletic success, team or individual level, is this ability to master stress in the moment and in the medium term. It's not simply just in a situation. It's chronic stress and chronic pressure and chronic demands. So the first book was really about kind of formulating my experiences and bringing a scientific piece to it. It's very mechanistic, how this whole thing works, how it all plays, what is the strategy? And I identified in the first book kind of basically four pillars. That's how you think, how you relate to other people, how you regulate the stress response, and how you look after your health. If you do those four things well, it like really falls into place. And I spent about 4 years putting this book together and going through paper after paper after paper. I wanted it to be really well validated from a scientific perspective. And I must have read, there was no ChatGPT to summarize anything. It was like I read each paper and I had to understand and I had to process and I had to digest. It was a great learning exercise to all the things that I've seen. I really understood them mechanistically and it really gave me a tremendous depth of insight. And get through that process, and I put together a manuscript. And it's not to say that because you love a topic and you might have applied the topic and you might be semi good at the topic, it makes for a good writing. So I put together a manuscript, and I think, oh, it's going to be a absolute, you know, the publishers are going to go crazy for it. No, they didn't go crazy for it. No, it's too complicated, it's too scientific, it's not right, it's not right for an
Too
audience.
niche.
And yeah, you know, it's a lot of rejections. In fact, there was a pile of, so I decided, okay, so you know, I've gone through all this effort. Maybe, you know, maybe I'll just self-publish, and I'll give it a few friends. At least, you know, it's something that I've consolidated, and it could be like a workbook. So I contact one of the companies in Cape Town, and they help me self-publish. Great editor, and it turns out the editor becomes my teacher. Becomes like really good writing teacher. She was phenomenal. And really taught me the basics and taught me principles and taught me everything that I didn't know about writing. She was a guide for months. She was an incredible, incredible. I'm very grateful to her. And what happened? I self-published and the book comes out. And what happens is I circulate to a few friends. And you know, friends are very generous. They buy, I think I print 500 copies, and friends buy a few copies here and there. And I'm still like kind of like reeling in terms of like trying to come to terms with the fact that there was the countless rejections. It was my passion. I thought it was going to be amazing. Still coming to terms with that. And one thing led to another. At Pan Macmillan, like one of the most influential, one of the biggest publishing houses in the world, gets a copy of the self-published book, and they said, "Look, this is." We like it. Yeah, this is good. Let's will you consider kind of coming on board and doing a little bit of a jig here and there, and let's see where it goes. And turned out to be a very, very the first book turned out to be very, very successful. Multiple print runs, bestseller. So it's, it's one of those situations where the opportunities in the crisis,
Yes.
the crisis was the rejections, forced to grow and forced to evolve and forced to learn and brought it together. I had tremendous inputs. My wife was a big support in this. The publisher, the editor, it just really was quite an extraordinary journey, and I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah, very few books are written in isolation. There's always an incredible team behind books, which it's very humbling, and it's such a wonderful part of the process.
And I think the big thing that stands out is that there were times where I lost belief in the process. I lost belief in myself.
Sure.
And it's, my wife picks me up, oh, come on, you're better than that.
Yeah.
And the editor picks me up, and it's they're really, I think that any work that we have, any work that's on a shelf, is not actually really not our work. It's a
Oh, yeah.
collection of team of individuals who've come together to take an idea and shape it.
Absolutely. That is exactly what it is. It's never just the author. You get credited as the author, but it's never just about us. There's so much else that goes into it. It's incredible. So, as someone on the forefront of performance science, let's put it that way, what is exciting you about new developments in neuroscience, technology, AI, even? Where do you think these technologies could either hold us back, or where could they take us in your field?
It's a very exciting time. It's like we have access to information that we never had access to. It's quick, it's easy. I feel that this whole performance science is needed now more than ever for a number of different reasons. Because I think the expectations that are placed on our shoulders are unrealistic.
Yes.
We're now being compared to an agent. An AI agent, it's unrealistic. We don't have these capacities. We can't go through the lines. We have these limitations. And I think everyone is questioning self to a certain extent, relevance, contribution. So I think right now there's this huge opportunity to upskill in terms of capacities that are going to help us in this new reality, this uncertain reality. And most of us are not, we can handle demands, we can handle expectations, that's no issue. Sometimes a bit overwhelming, sometimes hard, but the reality is what we don't like is uncertainty.
Yes.
And 35% of people have a condition, medical condition, called intolerance to uncertainty, and it's the
Right.
biggest driver of anxiety. There's a 90% correlation between that and anxiety.
Right.
So I think in this time, if we can prepare ourselves for a new reality, we can draw, from a technological standpoint. We've got metrics that can help us understand ourselves better. We can then input it to provide frameworks and guidance and structure and control.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think really the opportunity at this point in time is, yes, you have to leverage off, and yes, you're going to grow, you're going to expand in your insights, in your knowledge, but it's the application that's the difficult part. And the application really starts with the conversation we have with ourselves, and
Yeah.
boils down to that day in Saldana for me. It's that
Yeah.
self-dialogue. We can do this. We will do this. As opposed to it's overwhelming, it's compromising. But I think the only challenge that we're facing with this rapid advancement is our capacity to input and understand all the information we're being exposed to. So there was a great team at the University of California going back to 1986, and they're kind of asking the question, like, how much information did the average adult who's a high performer have to process and have to calibrate? When I say calibrate, absorb, disseminate, reject, discard, whatever it is, in 1986. And you go back to 1986, it's crazy. I mean,
Wow.
it was stages. It's like things didn't work in 1986.
Yeah.
So basically, they calculated that each newspaper at the time was about 80 pages, and you'd have to process 40 newspapers that are 80 pages in length every single day. This is 1986.
That's a
So it's
lot.
the, yeah, it's a lot. The conversations you have, the engagements you have, the labels you read, the pages you read, the documents you write. It's 40 pages or 40 newspapers, 80 pages. Did a calculation saying, okay, well, what did it look like 21 years later, 2007? In 2007, you're starting to look like in the hundreds, 120, 127. I mean, it's crazy how it just amplified. So 2007 compared to today is if you did the same modeling, we're having to process 500, 522 newspapers a day worth of content. When was the time you read a document without skipping words? We're so used to skip. Everything in life is scanning. Why? Because we can't process so much information, and it's really impactful. So you've got like really strong mathematicians, a guy called Suni Lehmann at the University of Copenhagen, saying that our attentional resources, that's it. Like we're done. We can't continue. So it's not about more information. It's about steadying the ship. That there's a wealth of information. It's making the right choice as to what information needs to be inputted, applied, and disseminated. It's a very complex time. Very exciting, very daunting. Very complex, but we have to remain very composed and very centered amid this chaos that is the world today. Positive chaos.
And I suppose it also sounds cliché, but getting the balance, pulling yourself away from that, letting your brain calibrate, paying attention to other things that don't strain you, stress you, or suck the life out of you. That's even more important right now, is to find the off switch amidst all this
And you
craziness.
mentioned burnout earlier, and kind of you asked like the question, how does one manage burnout? I never really answered that, but from a everything strategy, you kind of zoom out, take a perspective, how we're going to manage it. There's a physical component to burnout. Manage the physical. There's a behavioral component to burnout. Manage the behavioral. There's a connection. When you burn out, we tend to withdraw. There's a connection piece, and there's a metacognition. I know myself. I can control myself piece. So there's kind of these four elements. But one of those big elements when looking at the physical is like step one, reduce information flow, boundaries. There has to be a time in the day where that is the line. I'm not checking my phone. I'm not checking my mails. I'm not checking my PC. I'm not boundaries. And then there's got to be relationship boundaries. It's not just technological boundary, but relationship boundaries. That one day a week where it's only for my family, or it's only for me. And then environmental boundaries. There's got to be 2 hours a week or 3 hours a week where I move away from the lights and the electromagnetic fields, and I go into nature, where the nature's your garden, or where the nature's a park, where the nature's a mountain. And it's so many of these pieces have to be put together. But I feel that the biggest piece, I mean, this is a little bit of a digression, but the biggest piece in terms of managing burnout, and it's been very important for me, is creating this small window of time for yourself. And that time is purely for personal growth. We have to grow. That's our meaning. That's our purpose. That's our fulfillment. And when you're on that treadmill, we stop completely. There's no time. So it can be 30 minutes in the morning. I'm going to read this, study that, listen to this. I'm going to engage with the world in that way. It's for me to grow, to develop, to evolve. You place that in the routine on a daily basis. Watch what happens.
Yeah, that's where the magic happens.
So the magic happens, yeah.
So before we wrap, let's talk about your upcoming book. What is it called? What is it about? When can people get their hands on it?
So the book's title is Shift Happens, and it'll be available in the next couple of months, so around the October mark.
Wonderful.
This book is kind of it almost falls in the same continuum. This book is about transformation. So if I go back to my first book, it was you can't move forward in life unless you master your stress. First book is mechanistic. It's on the systems and process to get on top of that stress. The second book was on I've got families, I've got teams, they stress, it's going to impact me. My responsibility is to help them manage their stress, create the right ecosystem. Second book was on managing stress for others because it's so impactful. The third book was on preparation for the future. It was, we're going into a future that's uncertain. We don't like uncertainty. We don't like the change. We don't like the chaos. Human beings, we like to know what comes next. Even if it's hard, we like to know what comes next. This book answers a deeper question. It's about transitions and transformation. A lot of us are reflecting on our lives, and we feel stuck, we're not moving, or we feel bogged down, or the weight of our experiences is detracting from who we are. And this book is about finding yourself, and it's about transforming oneself. And what are the tools? What are the skills? What do we need to have in our daily life in order to bring about this 2.0 version? And it is so accessible. It's so achievable. It's such a remarkable thing.
I can't wait to get hold of your new books. And you said October this year.
October this year.
Okay, good.
October this year.
Good. So Richard Sutton, where can people get hold of you if they want to bring you into their organization, if they want you to do a keynote, or just make contacts?
I think LinkedIn's probably the best platform at the moment. So I'm quite active on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn's a great platform. Also through my website at suttonhealth.co.uk.
All right, I'll pop that through in the show notes and make sure everyone can get hold of you. And in the meantime, thank you so much for your time today. I absolutely loved our conversation. And there's so much to take away and think about. So yeah, that was absolutely wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
If this conversation with Richard made you rethink how you approach stress, resilience, and performance, then get hold of Thrive, Stress Proof, or the Stress Code and start putting some of these frameworks into play. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone you know who's in the trenches right now. And as always, experiment, apply, and iterate, because the point isn't to avoid stress, it's to turn it into something that fuels your best work and your best life. You can get in touch with Richard through his LinkedIn profile and via his website. And don't forget to look out for his new book, Shift Happens, on shelves everywhere from October 2025. Please don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.